I don't need to tell you that the ranching game can be a heartbreaker. But I can offer you something that'll never let you down, and that is switching to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug is a company that does things right. They start with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded, and they custom roast it with love just for you when you order it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. No matter what you like, there's a blend of Sparkplug for you, including decaf and half-calf. So why are you settling for mediocre, stale coffee sold at most grocery stores or cafes when you can have the best coffee you've ever tasted delivered right to your home or office? Sparkplug even offers autopilot delivery so that you'll never have to worry about running out. And right now, Sparkplug is offering a special deal to Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The offer only applies to coffee, but it applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? You've got to dip your bread in the gravy while it's still hot. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Howdy, movie moguls, and much obliged for saddling up the next 107 project, the weekly podcast that tongue wags about motion picture goodies. Our tongue wags are jam-packed with spoilers, so beware. I'm your bed-hopping, no-good Texas cattle rancher, Ryan Ellis, and this is the irascible old coot who runs that ranch, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
You thought I'd call you Alma, didn't you?
I thought I would get to be HUD. You usually give me the best character.
Failure! So the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, and you just said it, HUD! HUD! Name all the Paul Newman movies that start with the letter H. What a trivia question. And we're not including the at the beginning of the title.
Okay, so I counted eight of them, and they are The Helen Morgan Story, The Hustler, Hemingway's Adventures of a Young Man, HUD, Harper, Ombre, Harry and Son, and The Hudsucker Proxy.
And she raced through those for no reason whatsoever, but she's accurate, and she's right. Three of those, in fact, were directed by the HUD director, Martin Ritt. The trivia may not be interesting necessarily, but how about that? The guy, Paul Newman, that is, was in eight movies with H. Let's move on. Enough of that H stuff. So HUD was nominated for the 1998 AFI Top 100 list, but those dickweeds didn't see fit to recognize it as one of the 400 in 2007. Paramount Pictures released the pick one day shy of 55 years ago on May 29th, 1963. People came out in pretty big numbers to help make it a success. Bev, people like skinnies with our podcast, and if they don't, well, whatever. Read them the skinny of HUD right now.
All right, for those of you who don't remember what the movie's about, Melvin Douglas, Paul Newman, and Brandon DeWilda are Homer, HUD, and Lonnie Bannon, three generations in a family of cattle farmers in Texas coping with a potentially disastrous breakout of disease in their livestock. The crisis amplifies existing tensions in the family, stemming mostly from HUD, who's a real son of a bitch, with a mite too much influence on his teenage nephew.
Or, in a nutshell, HUD'll fuck anything that moves! Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet style. And they all want to fuck the maid. He didn't mention her. Patricia Neal's Alma.
One of the best things about the movie.
And also the shortest Best Actress Oscar winner in history.
Is that right?
She's only on screen for a handful of minutes.
She makes such an impression on the film, though, and it would be so lost without her.
I didn't mark down how long she's in the movie, but it's not very long. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on HUD. 84% of critics liked the film, 21 fresh and 4 rotten, so obviously we're looking at a classic movie here because 25 reviews is pretty small, and 89% of audiences. The movie has a very stark opening with a simple music theme. It's drenched in sex and sexual undertones, also daddy issues and absent mommy issues. And this was your first time seeing a movie with all those things in it. What did you think of Paul Newman and Martin Ritt's HUD?
Well, anyone who knows me knows that this movie is totally my jam. It's a thoughtful, somewhat nihilistic examination of a dysfunctional family. Sign me up. HUD really sticks the landing. The story threads get a little boring here and there, but how could you fail to be engaged by the beautiful, nuanced language and that wonderful script? Cinematographer James Wong Howe gives us one heartbreakingly perfect shot after another, but the main event is the four actors. They elevate the good material into a great film. Not that I've seen all of his films, but I'm a Paul Newman fan, and I don't think I've ever seen him give a more nuanced and rich performance. And Patricia Neal conveys just an ocean of depth in Alma.
You haven't seen all of the H movies for Paul Newman,
though. I haven't.
Well, I will recall what we said in The Hustler last year? 2 years ago, it must have been. His co-star in that film, George C. Scott, said that his Hustler performance, Newman's, was okay, nothing special. But in Hud, he thought it was great. I like Hud a lot. Hustler, to me, is one of the movies that could have made the AFI Top 100 list.
Surprised it didn't.
I'm not really so sure that Hud could have. But performance-wise, what do you think between Hustler and Hud for Newman?
Like I said, I liked his performance in Hud better. I like his performance in The Hustler a lot. It's very similar, where he's playing a son of a bitch that hates himself. Something he comes back to over and over again, and something he does well because he has such a natural charisma and sex appeal, and just appeal, period, that he can play a son of a bitch and the audience doesn't hate him. You're still drawn to him.
That's part of the problem, is that Newman said, maybe it's a frustration of the film. I think he likes the movie. I'm sure he liked his performance. But he was disappointed that he played this guy as a bad guy, a flat-out villain. And yet he became a hero to an awful lot of the youth out there.
That happens a lot. And I can think of two examples that are pretty similar. One is Gordon Gekko. He's a clear, flat-out villain who goes to jail at the end.
But he's worshipped.
But is still worshipped by bad Wall people, Street though. Jerks. Also with Wolf of Wall Street. Jordan Belfort is an ass. He's a monster in that film.
What about Darth Vader, also worshipped by people?
But he's a villain. People don't want to be Darth Vader the way they want to be Gordon Gekko. They want to be Hud. I don't see it. Like, I see movies like that, and I can find those characters engaging, and I can empathize with them. And as bad as Hud is, you feel more sympathy for him, maybe even almost pity, than you do hate for him.
And that's about the ending, because there's an awful lot of pity you can feel for him when the movie's over. We'll get to that later on. My feelings in the movie, well, I picked it. I thought you had to see this movie. That's one of the reasons why this whole project started over 5 years ago, was Bev had to see the classic movies, so let's podcast about them. And then, of course, we took off, and here we are, way past the top 100 project movies. This is one movie you would have definitely had to see if we had just been watching movies and there's no podcast involved. It's one of my favorites of his performances. Absolutely, it's one of the best movies of that year, 1963. We'll get to that later on about how that was kind of a weak year. But here's an original film that sets the tone right off the bat with Hud boning some other guy's wife and lying to the guy about it, selling out his nephew as well. Hud drives a pink Cadillac, and Newman's got those famous blue eyes. Paul Newman in a pink Cadillac. How is this movie, James Wong Howe's cinematography, gray as it was, notwithstanding, how is this movie not in color?
That's actually a really great question. Probably it was a budget thing.
Well, also, if you make it in color, then you show Newman's eyes, you show the pink Cadillac, and maybe everybody likes him right off the bat, rather than, okay, it's Paul Newman, but I can't really see him very well. I don't know if that's really the mentality. It might be. They go by that kind of stuff in screen tests and in the preparation of a film a lot of the time, especially back then when you could have done black and white or color.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine that there was a time when that was a really valid choice. Not that it's not a valid choice now to do something in black and white, but it's certainly a stronger choice. Yeah, it's a deliberate choice, and it's kind of a choice that is going to forever take the audience out of your film. You're going to see a film that's in black and white now is like a way of reminding your audience constantly throughout it that they're watching a movie. But that wasn't true in the 60s. People were very used to watching black and white. All television was still in black and white. So it was a different choice to make, and it's hard to put it in today's context. So I have a question for you. How do you rate this amongst Newman's performances? You've seen more of Newman's films than I have.
I don't agree with George C. Scott or you about Hud being better than The Hustler. I think they're on the same par, but if I had to choose between the two, maybe because I prefer The Hustler as a flat-out movie better, that I would choose that performance better. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, yeah,
I see. To me, it's a push. It's not like if somebody said, which one do you like better? It has to be Hud, and it's not The Hustler. You're wrong, you fucking idiot, if you say it's The Hustler. Okay, fine, I'll go with Hud then.
I have to embarrassingly admit that I can't remember which movie came out first.
Hustler was 61, Hud was 63.
Oh, so maybe his performance of Hud was informed by all the work he did in The Hustler. Maybe Ritt was just a better director for him, in my opinion. Maybe Ritt just worked really well with him, and that's why he kept working with him over and over again. He got this amazing performance out of him. And I have to say it again, Patricia Neal. I mean, all four of the actors were absolutely amazing, but to me, Paul Newman and Patricia Neal were just outstanding, some of the best performances I've ever seen in cinema.
It's funny we're talking about four great actors, because the four great actors, I think all four were nominated. Am I wrong about that? In The Hustler, Newman, Piper Laurie as love interest, George C. Scott, and Jackie Gleason. Another great foursome.
Yeah, a lot of similarities between the two movies.
And then Newman's so relaxed and different and great in Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid and The Sting and some of his later films, The Verdict. Love Nobody's Fool. We could rattle off Paul Newman movies for the next 20 minutes straight. But as far as the HUD Hustler era in the early 60s, when he was really coming into his own, yeah, I'll go with The Hustler over HUD, but we're talking about great stuff. Okay, Patricia Neal. Her character's got a very interesting tightrope to walk in this movie. She's one woman on a ranch with all these men, especially the two horny Bannons. Now, I said they all want to fuck the maid. I don't really include Homer in that, but the two younger guys, meaning Newman and DeWilda, are into her, and there's a lot of sexual undertones, like I said, all through the film. I love the line that Newman has, Alma, you want to blow some foam off of some beer? Blow. I don't think he meant it that way, but it's probably written that way. It's a euphemism for a lot of other things. And then, of course, the awful scene towards the end where HUD sexually assaults her and is primed to rape her. And maybe he would have, but Lonnie stops it. What he does do is bad enough. He certainly could be charged for what he does to her before Lonnie even steps in.
In the book, he rapes her. They changed it for the movie because they just thought it was too much and they didn't want to totally lose the audience.
In the book, she's also black. And I almost wish she'd been black because it would have been even more subtext behind people who are doing okay, meaning the Bannon family with the cattle, until the foot and mouth thing happens in the story of this film. But you know where this is going to go is that HUD's going to be an oil rancher. Homer even says at one point, you can do what you want with this land when I'm dead. When Homer dies and HUD is saying there's oil under the ground, that's what it's going to be. HUD is going to be James Dean and Giant, the oil baron who nobody loves, and he doesn't love anybody, but all these people in the past he probably loves, but he's got nobody in his life, but he's rich beyond belief. He's the asshole. This is Giant, which was a very famous film, and it made the original AFI list done even better. You weren't a big fan of that movie. I still like Giant. It's way too long, but this is a very similar story, but that's one of the big subtexts. That movie actually shows you an oil baron midway through and then towards the end with James Dean. This one's going to be about what's going to happen later on. So if you've got the future multimillionaire flat out rapes the black maid housekeeper character. Great subtext. Text, really.
Yeah, that's a good point. You brought up Giant, and I'll just give away what I was going to keep for my final thoughts. In my opinion, this film should replace Giant on the list.
Be a good trade-off.
It's better. It's like very similar
set scenes. In the same state.
Yeah, so many similarities, but this is a good movie where Giant was kind of dumb.
Giant doesn't age that well. HUD has, maybe because it's more authentic, feels more real, doesn't feel as dated as Giant did when we watched it, although I still enjoy Giant.
HUD feels very universal. It's so real and authentic in dealing with such present and universal human emotions.
I mentioned that we see HUD leaving a lover's house, and the man comes home, and then HUD pawns it off that Lonnie's the one who's with her, which is such a jerk-off thing to do. But it's a great way to set the tone of the way HUD's been, probably for many years in this little town, and what he gets away with because he's Paul Newman. But I also like this touch, which is a bit of a bizarre thing. The shopkeeper is sweeping up broken glass in the morning when Lonnie goes to find HUD, many hours after the brawl. So they have the brawl, and apparently it's caused by HUD. Then he takes care of it the next day.
I know, I noticed that too.
It's one of those things where it has to happen for the story to imply that something happened the night before. But then again, hey, living in a big city like Toronto, I have ridden home, and you have too, probably. Well, me more so after night shifts, because I've done night shifts for many years. With broken glass on the streets many times, and you're doing the whole sort of, can I swerve wide into middle of what would be traffic when no one's around, thank God, on Saturday and Sunday mornings when I ride home? Because, good God, there's an awful lot of broken glass out there on those days.
When I used to live more downtown Toronto, and I would be walking my dog in the morning and have to watch out for vomit from people drinking the night before.
So the main story in this film is something I'd never heard of until I watched HUD. And it's foot and mouth disease, or hoof and mouth disease, I guess the same thing, which is death for cattlemen. Now that's what bothered you, I think, am I right in saying this, as much as the attempted rape scene when they slaughter those cattle.
Those two scenes were both really hard to watch, like in a good way, because the film is kind of bleak and it's dark and it really doesn't shy away from bad things happening to these people, but in a very nihilistic way, especially the cattle. It's nobody's fault. The right thing to do, despite the argument he's having with HUD, because HUD just wants to sell the cattle to someone else and sneak them out and make them someone else's problem.
Make it spread.
Well, and that would spread it. It would screw over the people you sold the cattle to. It's just altogether the wrong thing to do, but to do the right thing means to just absolutely bankrupt yourself. If Homer hadn't died, they would be in real trouble. They would have no way of making a living. They would very likely lose the ranch altogether. it would destroy their family, but it's what you have to do. They also don't skirt around the fact that these are their cattle. These are animals, even though if they're raising them for slaughter, they're still animals that they care for, that they care about. It's their livelihood, but it's also creatures that they have to cruelly destroy. Well, I guess it's not cruel, but it's not pretty either. And I love animals. I hate watching animals get hurt in movies. It felt very real. Obviously, they didn't really hurt any cows, and I know the Humane Society was there making sure that everything was above board, but it feels like that's how they would probably do it. Digging the hole. Oh, God, the whole scene. It goes on forever, doesn't it?
Drags on, but it's appropriately dragging on because you have to set up the whole thing. I don't know that you see any cattle being killed. It's more about they get pushed into that pit or driven into that pit, and then the shotguns get
pulled out. The rest is done with audio.
And you don't need to see anything.
No, you really don't. So the movie really wants you to face it and feel the pain of it. It's not just an abstract thing that happens. And very similarly, that rape scene. So much attention is paid to her fear and her fight in that scene. It's visceral. It lives and dies on her performance. It's absolutely amazing. There's so many authentic nuances, but really hard to watch. Again, because of its authenticity. You know what's coming the whole film. The whole film makes that moment feel absolutely inevitable. And Alma knows it. I suspect this is not the first man who's tried to force himself on her. She more or less says so. She's in this impossible position. She uses her wit to fight back most of the time because she knows that she would only invite their anger if she outright said no, and she's known enough men like Hud to know better than to make him angry, even though he's constantly making passes at her, touching her, sexually harassing her in the workplace, as we call it now. But she isn't mad at the end. She's not scared of him at the end when she's at the bus stop. Like, I was very curious to see how that scene played out. And there was something about her position at the end. This is what you do. This is what men like you do. It's like the scorpion on the frog's back in the river. You know they're going to sting you.
He also does apologize, which is not common in even attempted rapes in movies or probably in reality. He knows he was wrong. It isn't an apology, but he says, okay, well, I was made to apologize. So if you're bothered by that, I'm sorry. No, he's saying, I was wrong and I'm sorry. So that's something at least.
And she admits to him that if he had just been kinder to her, maybe patient or maybe just waiting for the right time, they probably would have gotten it on.
He turned her on. She admits that. She doesn't put it in quite those words, but she might as well.
You called it a tightrope. Her performance is a tightrope. Well, her character is the one who has to walk a tightrope working in that family, knowing that these men are turned on by her, want to be with her, but that also puts her at peril and that her position as their employee.
We see her playing cards or coming out of playing cards with the ranch hands, and nothing's implied that anything happened there, but I'm just saying she's on a ranch with all these guys, not just three men, and Homer's not really the issue, but Lonnie too, even though he's a kid, and then all the ranch hands, so it's not just the Bannon she's got to deal with and worry about, but yeah, maybe because she's a tough broad, she gets away with not having to deal with worse until it actually finally happens with Hud. And why does it happen with Hud? It's funny because this is a guy that messes around with married women. Seems like that's what he goes for first and foremost. Maybe that's some kind of death sentence. Maybe that's some kind of, I'm going to go for the thing I can't really have. Because this guy could have anybody in the whole town and beyond. But he goes for the women he can have. And then when he actually makes a move on Alma, it's forcing himself. And he has to know that if he just romanced her a little bit, it was a little bit nicer, maybe something would have worked out. But it's almost like he can't do it that way. He's a self-destructive character.
And when does he do it? He does it after he has that heartbreaking fight with his father. And his father just says terrible things to him. Basically, he calls him a no-good human being that he can't live with.
He was sick of Hud a long time before. The brother, Lonnie's father, Norman, died, which was 15 years earlier in a car wreck. Hud was at the wheel, and of course that's a reprise later on, where Lonnie is in a car wreck where Hud is at the wheel. Now, Lonnie survives, at least. It's almost like it's going to happen again, but this time Lonnie at least gets away. And then he leaves very smartly from the ranch. He doesn't stick around because Hud's going to bring him down. When Alma's gone and Homer's died, thank God Lonnie gets out of there, and he knows better than to stick around. But anyway, Homer is saying, you were bad before, and that makes me wonder. We've seen Hud be an asshole all through the whole film, but is it bad parenting? Homer seems like a good dude. He's certainly great to Lonnie. He's good to Alma. He cares about his cattle. When he shoots those last two, what do you call them, longhorns?
Yeah, longhorns.
The movie's over for Homer. His character might as well shoot himself, because it's not long after he does die, when he's off on the ranch and they find him. And his last line actually is, Hud there is waiting on me, and he ain't a patient man.
Such a great line.
And it sounds like Hud does miss his brother Norman, But he is in line to inherit this ranch, despite what he thinks Homer's doing to it. And it doesn't really matter if the cattle die off. It doesn't really matter if they're slaughtered the way they are or if they live, because he's going to turn it into an oil field one day anyway.
So the death of his brother is the last thing he's reminded of before he takes the bottle, he goes outside, he goes after Alma. So he's angry in this moment, and he's in his deepest possible pit of self-loathing when he goes and decides to take it out on her and feel like at least there's one person that he can beat, that he can exert his power over.
It's almost funny that he's in a fight with his own father. But maybe that's the whole sexual tension in this whole film. And it's got to be a woman he goes after rather than fighting with his father. He'll try to fuck a woman.
If he raped Alma, there would be no consequences. If he fought his father, he could be expelled from the ranch. Who knows what could happen. And he wants his father's approval, but I don't suspect that he has a great deal of respect for women if he's willing to rape somebody.
As for those mad cow cows, they were Mexican cattle. We desperately need that border wall. But you know, Hud is the guy who fucks around. He's unscrupulous. He hates the government. He scorns everyone. He's a real good dude. He's good people. We also see him wallowing around in mud in the pig-catching contest, which looks a little like Rocky chasing chickens in Rocky II, and we saw that in Creed as well, reprised. The movie does have some unintentional violence, though. Lonnie probably suffers several concussions in this movie, including when he's dealing with cattle on the farm. He gets bashed into the wood, and then they let him malinger for the day. He's like the dude in The Big Lebowski. He's knocked out many times, so he's got some brain damage. And there's even bar brawling for fun. Hud starts a fight, and he and Lon are together. It's the one time that Lonnie and he are completely bonding, and it's a great time. But then I think that leads into the whole thing where they go in the house, and Homer tells him, "You were bad before." And Homer goes and ruins it all with the truth in that moment, but it's kind of silly that they have to bond over violence. Maybe that's what Hud and Norman did long ago as well.
I think Lon is just being a teenage boy. He looks up to Hud because Hud gets laid and Hud does what he wants and he's a cool guy and he has that charisma. But I don't think there's any doubt throughout the film that Lon takes after his grandfather and not his uncle.
Yeah.
He just flirts with behaving badly like 99% of teenagers. He's impressed by him, but he listens ultimately to Homer. And it's interesting, he seems more inclined to spend time with Hud and Homer than kids his own age, especially girls. You know, he goes to the movies with his grandfather while he sees his classmates there with their girlfriends. Is it that he's in no hurry to grow up? Is he shy? Is it that he's actually that in love with Alma?
He's gay.
I don't think he's definitely not gay. And when he walks away from the ranch, it kind of can seem like a bad ending. But really, I think that's the most optimistic part of the end of the film, because even a kid can determine that he's better off on his own than learning to live under Hud's roof. And he's choosing the harder path, but the path will make him a good man just like Homer, which is really what he is. But he's his own man, too. There's all these other little details. I love that he has the radio. It's this unnecessary detail, but it's this beautiful little character thing for him. It's this one persistent thing that sets him apart from both Hud and Homer, because neither of them like the radio, but a reminder that Lonnie is, in fact, his own person.
It's good that Lonnie walks away the way he does. It's not like he's sentimentalized. It's not like he's thinking about it. He's gone, and he doesn't seem to even care if he gets any of the profits from the ranch. It's an anticlimactic ending that makes sense. Hud is alone, and always will be alone from this point on. He says it earlier in the film, "Nobody gets out of life alive." Another good line. And this is my opinion, but Hud's going to go on to die of alcohol poisoning, or perhaps several STDs.
Or a car wreck, maybe.
Or a husband shooting him.
Yeah, that could be it.
He could live a long time. He could be like James Dean in Giant and be completely alone. But something bad's going to happen to him. Just being alone might be enough. I like the way the movie ends. When I first saw it, it definitely jarred me. But he slams that door shut, and then the end, the movie's over.
So the last thing you see is him smiling as he pulls the blinds down and shuts himself into that house. He has like a kind of smug expression on his face. He's drinking a beer. It's not an unhappy or angry expression on his face. It's like, yep, now I'm on my own.
I'll have to go back and look at that then.
Okay, but he's at the very least expressing a total lack of remorse or understanding. And after everything, he is still Hud, and he would rather shut out his own family and the whole world rather than concede to Homer's way, which will become Lonnie's way. And perhaps he's actually a little bit happy that he will no longer have the judgmental specter of his father and his nephew to get in his way.
And Hud did win, because if he's only really going to care about money and fucking unavailable women, he can do that all he wants to until something bad does happen to him.
But in your opinion, does he win?
If that's what he seems to really want, but he's one of those self-destructive characters. He talks about how his mother died. I said absent mommy issues. So there's that whole element too. This is a guy who wants his mother, maybe doesn't even think of it that way. They don't really imply these with older women, but maybe he is.
I think the movie's saying being a bad person is its own punishment. Lonnie's going to be fine. He's going to find love. He's going to make his own family. He's a good person. He'll be okay. But we know that Hud will not. So it's kind of like other movies about, other good movies, I should say, about bad people. Even if it seems like they win at the end, we understand that there's going to be the cosmic punishment. Not cosmic, just kind of like the human nature punishment that Hud is going to be alone. His years are probably numbered now because nobody's going to temper his behavior. But worse than that, he's going to be lonely. And this is just the inevitable consequence of his selfishness.
People like this win, though. That's why I keep looking at this movie with this unhappy ending, that for his character, if you do like him, if you do revere him the way a lot of youth did when they saw the movie in 63, and probably a lot of people who've seen the movie since on DVD or reprisals, that they can maybe look at the film as, Hud won out. Or they maybe don't look at it that way, but he did, because he got what he wanted in the end. The ranch.
You know what this movie just reminded me of? The criminally underseen young adult with Charlize Theron.
Which I watched again not that long ago, so we talked about it a lot during Monster, our podcast.
Yeah, we both love this movie, and it has a very contentious ending because she doesn't grow. She, at the end, is exactly where she started, thinks there's nothing wrong with her behavior. But that's her sad ending. Like, she has a sad life. And I feel the same about Hud. It's a sad ending that he doesn't evolve. He doesn't grow. He doesn't change into a good person or have any kind of enlightenment. I feel like it's more optimistic than it looks at first glance.
Maybe that's why Scott thought the performance was so great, because in The Hustler, he does change and does evolve, although he's not going to get to be a pool hustler anymore. But in Hud, yeah, he does really not go from A to F. He might go from A to C at best.
I think he goes from C to A. I think he kind of goes backwards a little bit.
But it's a movie without a great character arc from the main character, and yet it's still a great performance.
I think Lon is probably the one with the character arc in that he's naive and open to possibilities at the beginning of the film. He gets a little hardened but makes the right choice by the end.
He might be the main character, even though he's certainly not top billed.
Well, Hud was not the main character in the book. I think It was more of a kind of ensemble in the book.
But you want a star to get the movie made in the first place. Yeah,
but Lonnie was probably the focus in the book. Mm. But it was a star, and maybe it was just that they saw it between screenwriters and Paul Newman's involvement. They said, he's the most interesting character. This is what we should focus on.
The movie was based on Larry McMurtry's 1961 novel, another example of a novel being turned into a movie very quickly. And Horseman Pass By is what he called it. McMurtry did Last Picture Show, which became a movie, Terms of Endearment, which became a movie, and he wrote the Brokeback Mountain script along with Diana Ossana, I think is her name. So he's got four major titles, three of them being books first on his resume, and there's other things too, but he's a great Western guy with this and Last Picture Show, which is not really a Western, but you know what I'm saying. Also, that was black and white. So as far as that cast goes, everyone was professional on set. But apparently Newman and Neil and DeWilda were not happy on the set for various reasons. Newman was so in character that apparently during one of their downtime days, Newman and Neil were by the pool, and Neil opened up about a daughter, I think it was, that died, a kid or something like that that died, or a mother, I think it was a kid. Anyway, Newman's listening, but he's so into the Hud character, he said something like, "No, it's a tough break," and walked away. And apparently that really hurt her, really devastated her, but that's method acting for you. When you hear about Daniel Day-Lewis doing that kind of stuff, and obviously Newman did it here, James Dean did it, and we mentioned Giant a few times, I get why they do it, but you're not that person. Can you get out of it for 5 minutes, you fucking head-up-your-ass person? I love Newman, one of my favorite actors ever, but good God, the woman's telling you this story. Can you stop being Hud for 10 minutes?
It's called acting because you're acting. Pretending. You pretend for a living. You don't embody this person, although I can't fault any method that resulted in this performance.
Well, Newman's been in so many great movies. We've covered quite a few of them already. We talked about all the H movies, including The Hustler, but we covered Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid for the Top and Under Project. We covered The Sting not that long ago in our Oscar month a few years ago. A wealth of others. So many great performances. He had the Jimmy Dean-like method. He became a bit of a cattle rancher, which Dean did for Giant. I can't believe Giant's come up so much in this podcast, but they're comparable.
I can totally believe it. Yeah, they have a lot in common.
And he really wanted to get that lope down, the way he walks and talks and all that kind of stuff. And just like in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is only a few years before, with Elizabeth Taylor, who was in Giant, the death of an important person hangs over everything else, especially the Newman character in both Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and in this film. Because Lonnie doesn't seem to really know his father that much. He doesn't seem to be some sad, abandoned kid. Homer doesn't really dwell on the fact that his other son died. Doesn't seem to, outwardly. But HUD, without really talking about it, I think is more affected by that. And if you've ever seen Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, the play is supposed to be about how Brick, the Newman character, had a gay lover who died. And in the movie, it's about this close friend who died. But in both cases, this movie and that one, that death really does hang over everything else. Now, Patricia Neal is the maid, of course. We covered her on Day the Earth Stood Still in a performance that's fine and a pretty key performance in that film. But this is much better. She was also the benefactor in Breakfast at Tiffany's. So she's been in three movies we've covered, and I kind of forgot about the fact that she was in that movie. So that's obviously some good method acting on her part, and she blends into the part. I already say she's got the briefest performance in Best Actress history.
She doesn't stand out in those movies the way she stands out in this movie.
Oh, definitely not. And a whole different performance here. She's 1 year younger than Newman, or she was. I think she's died. No, he certainly has. But they make her look older, I think. She doesn't look like she's younger than he is. Now, maybe that's the movie star Paul Newman thing. Do you agree with me in the first place? Do you think she looks like more of the dish rag maid?
I think he looks older than you think he looks in this movie. She looks like she's 40. I don't know how old she was when they made the film, but she looks like she's lost the blush of her youth, but still a pretty viable woman.
You said,
right?
I think he looks older, so I think Newman...
I don't think he looks as young as you think he looks in this movie, if you think that she looks so much older than him.
Not so much older, but she looks older than he does.
And they, like, keep her barefoot and everything. Mm. They really dress her down, but you can't dress her down. She just exudes sexuality in this film as well.
Could argue
in this great way, too, in this very mature way.
You could argue it's summer in Texas, so she doesn't need shoes because she's hot all the time. Slaving over an oven and all that kind of stuff. Melvin Douglas, who is Homer, won his first of two Oscars in this movie. He won the other one for Being There in 1979. Maybe not the best choice either of those 2 years, but he's a good actor in these movies. He was in Ninotchka a long time before this. So he was in the glamour period of Hollywood in the late 30s. And interestingly, Sidney Poitier is also named Homer in Lilies of the Field, the best actor winner. Douglas was Best Supporting Actor in 1963, that same year.
It's not a common name either.
Homer. Brendan DeWilde, if you don't recognize that name so far, we'll say now, was in Shane. He was the kid in that great Western that we love so much way back when, or our Top 100 Project movies. He did more TV than movies, and then he died at 30 in a car wreck. And like I said, he was going through some tough times. I'm not really sure what exactly the tough times were. Newman's tough times may have just been that he was so into character, but apparently it was Melvin Douglas who commented on that. I don't think it was so much complaining, it's just that my three co-stars is not really a comfortable set. What's going on here?
Hmm.
And Neil, I think, was going through some marriage trouble. She was married to Roald Dahl, the guy who wrote Willy
Charlie
Wonka. That's what it is, not Willy Wonka, right. And James and the Giant Peach and so on. And I guess the other actor we should mention is Whit Bissell. So Whit Bissell, the cow veterinarian, who was in The Magnificent Seven, the original, of course, and Soylent Green. They're made of people! Their director was Martin Ritt, of course, who directed The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Norma Rae, and so many others. I thought about this earlier today. Even though this other director is definitely better and more famous, he's very similar in a lot of ways, though, to Sidney Lumet. He liked a lot of rehearsal like Lumet did. He covered issues topics in his later films, which Lumet did kind of through his entire career. Now, the difference here is that Ritt was blacklisted, and there is a blacklist influence in the whole movie because Ritt was blacklisted, Melvin Douglas was graylisted, and Newman was a liberal who, certainly in the Nixon administration, which was certainly after the blacklisting time, but then again, Nixon was part of all that. He was behind the scenes as a vice presidential guy. Anyway, the point is that you got major parts of this movie who dealt with being shunned, and of course, HUD is self-shunning, if you will.
I also saw that some critics saw the film as a representation of the conflict between baby boomers coming up in the 60s and their greatest generation parents, because baby boomers were seen as selfish, you know, the me generation. They were individualistic and had no respect for their parents, just like HUD.
Baby boomers are bothering me more and more as years go on. Everyone gets on the millennials. I think the baby boomers can suck a fucking cock way more than millennials can.
Retire already!
So the writers of HUD were Irving Rabich and Harriet Frank Jr. They were married. Rabich has many credits, including on Norma Rae, which Ritt did direct about 15 years later, I guess it was, something like that. And they based it on McMurtry's novel. The producers were Ritt and Rabich, who also produced Ombre for Ritt many years later. What did you think of the direction, writing, producing, all that stuff?
All positive things.
It didn't stand out in a good way, maybe, right?
No, it stands out wonderfully. The writing in particular, the language is so rich, and it's so Texas. I mean, I'm not Texan. I have no idea how authentic it is. But just as a person watching a movie, there's so much great nuanced, clever lines. A great line I remember was, "Oh, the only good thing my ex-husband ever did for me was scratch this itch on my back." Still get that itch, Alma? Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Such great language. The direction, of course, you got these fantastic performances out of everybody, but I also just think it was a well-directed film. The tone's really consistent. The pacing is good. It's shot beautifully. I think this is a great film. I think I like it better than you like it.
I love it.
Oh, there you go. But you're saying, like, it's not one of the greats. I'm saying I can't believe no, this film Hutt isn't on the top 100 list.
Between Hutt and The Hustler, I prefer The Hustler. Maybe because The Pool is a big part of the reason why I'm a big Pool fan.
I would struggle to choose between those two films. I think those are two great films. It's like a crime that neither of these films are on either of the AFI's top 100 lists. It's been a while since we've dwelt on the AFI 100 list, but this film really deserves to be talked about on that level,
I think. It comes up most of the time, I would say.
I wish it was more of a classic. I wish this was a film that more people saw.
I wonder how many people out there think that 2 weeks ago, because we took the week off, think The Adventures of Robin Hood was more worthy of the top 100 list, because the AFI certainly did. They liked it in so many different ways, and Hood, not so much.
And if you listen to that episode, then you would know I strongly disagree with that opinion.
She did. So the technicals on Hood, it was 2-5:1, and it was a black and white DVD that we watched. 2-5:1 widescreen and black and white as a combination always seems like a weird match to me. Not in a bad way. The Apartment did it in 1960 and won the Oscars, all of them pretty well. But it just seems like a weird thing. When you did widescreen movies, 2-5:1, the true widescreen, it tended to be that you had color as well, and that was where you'd market it. So when you do it almost downgrade in a way with black and white, because that what it felt like, it was more about the TV thing, it's more about small. And this movie is kind of small and intimate, despite the fact it's on a ranch, you got big settings, very small cast. But then you've got the wide vista at the same point. I like that contrast. Maybe that's the point. A movie that's all about contrasts.
And even though it's in black and white, and like we were saying, in the early 60s, it wasn't that unusual to shoot a film in black and white. At the very least, would keep your budget reasonable. Oh, and we haven't mentioned, this is the first film made in Paul Newman's own production company. Newman and Ritt just co-founded Salem Productions together, and this was the first production they made. So it could have honestly been a budget thing that they had to make a black and white film. But I think the 2-5:1 ratio is really just about those big Texas panhandle vistas. It's a bleak worldview. You have these bleak, massive landscapes that is the setting for this sad story, which is about losing life in many ways.
The cinematographer, James Wong Howe, you said him earlier, won an Oscar for this movie. I read that he wanted to make it even more stark than Ritt wanted. Ritt didn't like the way it was looking at first, and Howe said, let's make it even more stark than it already was. And I think he's right. You do see some clouds, but you see an awful lot of nothing. It's almost like a gray background in a gray way. He shot 132 movies in a 50-plus year career. He won 2 Oscars, and he's a black-and-white legend because most of his great movies were in black-and-white. We've covered a few of those. Yankee Doodle Dandy, Sweet Smell of Success, not two of my favorites, I guess, but Sweet Smell certainly is. He also shot Ombre for Ritt, and he loved his own work here, as he should have, because it is wonderful. The editor was Frank Bracht, and he cut White Christmas and The Odd Couple. So what an interesting threesome this is with Hood in there as well. And then the composer, we've covered this guy quite a bit in the last little while, Elmer Bernstein. Very understated score. I think you probably liked it. You must have. Agreed. To Kill a Mockingbird, The Ten Commandments, Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape are all on that list. We've covered 3 of those 4, well, 4 of those 5 with Hood. So you like the music then?
Yeah, I did. It was very understated, as I like it. And funny for like a composer who think about The Magnificent Seven. Really iconic. You can't miss it. Whereas the music in Hud is not imposing itself on you.
Or dun 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 dun.
Yes.
Dun 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 dun. 2 of the more classic scores of all time.
Absolutely.
Around this same time too. Same year, in fact, as The Great Escape. So some influences here, I think we mentioned a few of them, but Newman's character is Doc Hudson in Cars. That must have been deliberate. And I wonder if Hud in Cloverfield, the guy who's carrying the camera, which is T.J. Miller, is a reference to the character here, although other people can be called Hud, of course. But he's always Hud. I think he's actually Hudson, and then whatever his last name is in that film. But he's always Hud when they refer to him.
T.J. Miller, though, is just such a weak comparison to Paul Newman. If I were him, I wouldn't want to be compared to Paul Newman, let's put it that way.
As far as other influences go, the unloving father, who's vocally disapproving of his son. Now, this is shades of Rain Man, because we don't actually witness that, but we know that Tom Cruise's father was hard on him in that movie from before. We don't see any of that in the movie, and we covered Rain Man not that long ago.
I also think there was a lot of influence drawn from this for The Last Picture Show. I mean, for obvious reasons, same novelist, but when Bogdanovich was making that, he must have watched Hud. What made him decide to shoot it in black and white in the first place, but I think that there's also just a lot of similarities in the look of it, the tone of it, the feel. So he must have paid attention to what Rick did in this one.
The anticlimactic, dry, vista, western type ending as well is in the Last Picture Show. So the awards in the AFI list section is mostly about the Oscars. It won 3, Best Actress for Neil, Supporting Actor for Douglas, and James Wong Howe's Cinematography. It was nominated for Best Director for Rit, Best Actor for Newman, the screenplay and the sets, but did not win those. Neither Neil nor Douglas were at the ceremony back when nominees were often absent. That was a pretty common thing. It would be this person accepts on this person's behalf, whether it be the director or a friend or the Academy accepts. You don't see that very often anymore, that people don't show up. Newman is one of those actors who didn't show up all the time when you got into the more modern era, the 80s, the 90s, and into the 2000s. I don't think he was at a few of the nominations that he had, or Pacino sometimes missed out. De Niro wasn't always there in some of his nominations, but I don't know that really ever happens, except for Judi Dench in the really modern era that people aren't there, because I'm sure what happens is studios especially say, let's get the actor there to promote this thing, and it maybe helps your thing, even if it's a different studio.
I wonder if they put it in the contract. When you're signing to go on a film, if you are nominated for an award, you have to go to the show because it's promotion for the film.
That could be considering how many people missed out way back when in 1963. And in 1963, the Best Picture nominees were The Shits. America, America, which I recently saw, Elie Kazan's film, is fine. Cleopatra, which people pissed on, got nominated for Best Picture, probably because it really was, in the end, a moneymaker, despite the fact it cost so much. Lilies of the Field with Sidney Poitier was good. Halle West was one, which was shown on multiple screens, and that's a whole big technical thing. You can read about that if you want to. Tom Jones won the Oscar in 1963. I'm not really sure any of those are really necessarily worthy. This was also the year, though, of The Great Escape, not nominated. It's a mad, 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 hang on, mad world. Not one of my favorites, but a lot of people love that. And 8.5. But of course, Hud. And none of those are nominated for Best Picture. So 63 is one of my least favorite years when it comes to the Oscars because it's a pretty bad overlooking going on there. And Hud is also nominated for the top 100 quotes with, I'll remember you, honey. You're the one that got away. Because he wants only the women he cannot have. All right, well then, let's end Hud. Your last thoughts, Bev?
Well, I already spoiled my last thoughts by saying I think it belongs on the top 100 list.
I think it's a great film, too, and if we have to knock off anything, as we already said,
Giant, you're out of here.
Giant, or the second list. Last Picture Show made the second list, by the way. I don't know, let's spitball. Swing Time, bye.
Oh, God, yeah, Swing Time. There's so many. Oh,
or the Sixth list. Sense, maybe. It didn't really belong there. Yeah, Hud's a great one. I'm glad you liked it as much as you did, because you didn't like The Adventures of Robin Hood, which I didn't think you'd hate. I thought you might think it was okay. I didn't know if you'd love Hud, so I guess I was wrong on both counts. You liked one more than I thought you might, and you liked one less than I thought you might.
I'd like to keep my reactions extreme.
Newman was one of your favorites, too, and he does look great in this film, and he is great in this film. Hell of a performance. All the actors, though. So when our chittery chat finds its way onto your device next week, we'll review something I've been looking forward to discussing for a very long time, The Truman Show. Oh,
I can't wait for this one.
All right, this week's Coming Attractions trivia was not all that great of the H thing. This is probably even worse. I could not think of anything good for a movie I love, but here it is. The Truman Show is a reality show within the movie. What's the best legitimate reality show? Something that's actually existed. I will have no opinion on this because I do not watch reality shows.
I have a strong opinion.
And I already know what she's going to say.
Already knows what it is.
She's a survivor, not going to make it. Whatever that song is.
The original. Not really the original, but the original game show, reality show. Boy, I really gave away the answer to this one. Hey, in the meantime, why don't you let us know what you think the best reality show is? I'm sure there's going to be a great variety of answers.
There isn't one.
He's wrong about that. And if you'd like to let us know, you can reach both Ryan and me on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email. We'd love to hear from you guys. Top100ProjectPodcast@gmail.com. And you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We've covered over 250 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, you can give us a rating and a review. And what's more, before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. And it's not case sensitive.
Well, Fox over there is waiting on me, and he ain't a patient dog.
And cut.
I'm patient at all.